Tonight I want to talk first about some different Vipassana traditions. It can be interesting to know what kind of practices there are. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about practice in daily life, since this is the last full day. So there are many different Vipassana versions of Vipassana in Theravada Buddhism. And I will just mention some of the more well-known traditions and teachers, and the ones I also have personal experience with. So my first teacher in 1970 in India was Goenkaji, which you probably know about. But at that time, there was no Goenka movement and no Goenka centers anywhere. It was just Goenka just come back from Burma, where he grew up, even though he was an Indian business people family. But he came back to India because of some family problems. And he had just, well, then I guess his relatives and family realized that he was actually a meditation master. And so he started teaching his mother and his family. And then their friends wanted him to teach them. And so he had done a few retreats for Indian people. And then some Americans had somehow found out about this, and they arranged a retreat with him in a small place called Dalhousie in the north, in the foothills of the Himalayas. And then after that, they came to Delhi, where I met them. We happened to stay at the same hotel. And then they said something that has sort of, you know, stayed with me for all my life. Ehi Passiko, come and see. Come and see for yourself. We've met this meditation teacher, and he will have first a retreat in Bombay, and then we will go to Bodh Gaya, which is the little village in Bihar state where the Buddha got enlightened. And I thought, wow, this is really great, because usually, very often at that time, a lot of people came to India to look for a guru, you know. And if they found a guru of some kind, they weren't so willing to share, because a guru had sort of a higher status if there wasn't too many Westerners, if they had sort of their own Indian guru. So it was quite amazing that these people, Ehi Passiko, come and see, you're welcome. So, and I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I wasn't actually particularly interested in a guru either. I had more worldly interests at that point. But anyway, I thought it might be a good thing to try. So I went with them first to Bombay and then to Bodh Gaya. And that's that's the start of the whole thing. And now this going, then the retreats, I think, were quite different, because it was the first, or actually the second retreat that was with any Westerners was the one in Bombay, but it was still in Hindi. So we got some sort of special treatment with Goenka, just the five of us, where he talked to us in English and so on. But then the retreats in Bodh Gaya, they were all in English. The first retreat, there was maybe 30 people or something like that. But somehow the word spread about this fantastic meditation retreat. So more and more hippies came from all over India, and they had to rent one of these Indian party tents, you know, and put it up. The retreats were held in the Burmese Vihar, the Burmese monastery in Bodh Gaya, and it had a flat roof, so they put this big Indian party tent on the roof so that people could sleep there because there was no room anymore inside the building. So it was really fun, and it wasn't. Nowadays the Goenka retreats are known to be very strict, but at that time they hadn't formed all those rules that came later. So it was quite, we didn't even have silence all the time, just I don't remember exactly, but there was, I don't remember if it was part of the days or it was some days in retreat, in the retreat, but anyway, it wasn't silent all the time, so you get to know all these people, and yeah, it was a really good time. And now, I mean, it has changed, and now it's a worldwide movement that has centers in almost every country. I guess they have some in Finland, in Sweden they have one that it's not so old. And it's a sort of, if you haven't tried that meditation, it focuses only on the sensations of the body, this body scanning that is quite popular also in secular mindfulness that comes from that tradition. And it's quite sort of non-intellectual, as I remember it. Goenka said that you don't have to read any books or anything. If you meditate, the Dhamma will reveal itself to you. And yeah, it's worth trying, I think. It's a good method. The only thing you have to be aware of is that they say that it's the way Buddha taught, which is, I've been talking to you about the Satipatthana Sutta, which is what they base their assumptions on. And it doesn't say anything there about sweeping the body, you know, body scanning. The Satipatthana Sutta is very general, what things you should be aware of, but not how exactly. So that's why there's so many different methods in Vipassana, because different teachers, different monasteries, they take some part of the Satipatthana Sutta and then they develop a technique from that. So, but otherwise, I highly recommend that you go to a Goenka retreat, because they're very accessible, you know, you can go to them everywhere, and they are for free. But you're supposed to give dana, of course, but they don't have a set fee, which is good for young people that don't have so much money and so on. So it's 10 day and it can be quite tough, what I hear from people. They have strict rules and things, but well, so that was my first experience, even though it wasn't as tough as it is now. And then, so that was, I was hooked on Buddhism then, after that. I saw that this was a philosophy that was resonating with me, because I'd never had sort of very much belief in a god up in the sky or something like that. So then I went home to Sweden, and then next time I traveled I went to Thailand. And at that time there was a monastery, and there still is that monastery, but I don't really know what's going on there now. It's called Wat Suan Mok, And the teacher there was Achan Buddhadasa, and he's very well known, at least in Thailand. And at that time, many foreigners came there because he was one of the very few Thai teachers that could speak fluent English. So there were some Western monks there helping teaching, and every month, and this is still happening, I know, I saw on their webpage, every month there is a retreat starting on the first day of the month, and 10 days there is a retreat. They have a international Dhamma center a kilometer away from the actual monastery, and that's where those retreats are, and that's a really beautiful place with hot springs. So that's also worth visiting. And then I had heard from Joseph Goldstein about this teacher Upandita Sayadaw, who was sort of in, you know, there are different fashions actually in Vipassana, where some different teachers are in demand, sort of everyone wants to see them, and Upandita Sayadaw was the teacher that had he had the reputation of being very strict but a real wise master, and it was in the tradition of Mahasi Sayadaw, his teacher. And Mahasi Sayadaw was one of the people that sort of, you know, Vipassana meditation had been very much in the monasteries, not so much with lay people. But Mahasi Sayadaw, and also Goenka's teacher, what's his name again? Ubakin, yeah. They also started to give meditation courses to lay people, to spread it to the lay people as well. And so this tradition is where the mental noting comes from. You know, you make little mental notes when you breathe, rising, falling, when you reaching, touching. You know, you make mental notes of everything, and when you walk, lifting, moving, placing, and so that's what's typical for that method. And also that you should sit and walk very continuously, and be mindful the whole time, and walk, move very slowly. They tell you to start moving very slowly, because then you can observe every detail. And they also tell people to read the scriptures. They stress that the fourth foundation of mindfulness, Dhamma, understanding both practice and theory. So I think that actually the Mahasi technique is the one that is really covers all the four satipatthanas, all the four foundations of mindfulness. So I think it's a very good practice, but very intense. So the thing to watch out with that practice is striving, not being too tense and start striving, you know. Because they actually somehow makes you think that you can, yeah, that striving has some value, which I don't really think it has, but anyway. And there is a monk in England, Bhante Bodhidhamma. He has a small monastery called Satipanya, I think it was. And so you don't have to go to Burma, you don't have to go to the Mahasi Center in Burma, you can go to England if you want to try that. And then another very famous teacher in Thailand was Achan Chah, That's Jack Kornfield's teacher, and also other of the Western monks have. And it's called the Forest Sangha, and they have also all the monasteries in England, Amarvati and Chithurst and whatever. I think there are some more. And they have just opened a monastery in Norway, in a place called Shipvet. And the Forest Sangha tradition is more... they don't stress continuous meditation so much. It's more a ascetic life in a collective spirit where sort of people have to learn to handle living together in quite simple conditions and handle their conflicts and their, you know, in that way weaken their selfishness and learning to let go of things and so on. Meditation is more like a way to make your mind calmer so that you can see where you're stuck, where your hang-ups are, and where you get angry and so on. So I've never met Ajahn Chah. He died quite before I was into meditation too much. But I've met many of his monks. They have retreats at Insight Meditation Center every year, the monastic retreat. And so it's an interesting thing as well. And now, the latest fashionable teacher that also comes here to Finland is Ute Chania, Saida Ute Chania. And his thing is mindfulness of the mind, citta nupassana. And that is sort of some of the things I've been saying about the attitude of the mind is very important. And you can ask yourself questions about what's happening now, what is the mind doing now, and things like that, to remind yourself to be present. And when he doesn't travel around and giving retreats in the West or in everywhere, in China, in Malaysia, I don't know, he's got followers all over Asia as well. But in the winter time, he's usually in the Shui Umin Monastery, which is in a suburb of Yangon called Mingaladon in Burma. And so you can go there too. So I just wanted to make this a little bit, you know, some people have asked about where to go and so on. And these are some different traditions that you can try. So there are several different ideas about this, the best way to practice, but the ultimate goal is almost always the same, and that's Nibbana, awakening and liberation from the three root poisons, as they're called, greed, hatred, and ignorance. And here in the West, we really have the privilege of being able to choose and try out different things and maybe even combine different approach to the Dhamma. I mean, it's not only Theravada Buddhism, you have Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. And in Asia in the old days, in the past, people usually didn't know much about other traditions or other teachers. They had their village monastery with some monks, and maybe monks could walk around, but not very far, and there was no mass media and no internet and things like that. So we are really fortunate to be able to, we know actually much more, I think, than people used to do. And now also in the last years, there's come a lot of new translations of the Pali scriptures. Because before, even in the 70s, when I started meditating, there weren't so many translations, and the translations that existed weren't very good, because they were usually made by English scholars, you know, when the British Empire was in India and Burma and these countries. And so usually they had a sort of Christian overlay, or people that translated them were scholars and had never meditated. So they didn't even really know what they were talking about. So the translations turned out quite strange. But now Bhikkhu Bodhi and Tanissaro Bhikkhu are two monks, Western monks, that have done really good translations of the Pali scriptures, which is good. But, I mean, Buddhist theory, you can study and you can think that it seems really sensible and it fits your own opinions, and you think, well, I was a Buddhist all the time. And you can go to some retreats and maybe you have some really cool or beautiful or less beautiful experiences. But in some way, you still don't see a really big difference in your life. It's still troublesome and annoying as it was before. Because using all this information that you have received in this retreat and other retreats, and embodying these experiences and using them in daily life, that's the most difficult task of all. And so in order to live according to our understanding, we must make a certain effort, because it goes against our habitual programming, conditioning about how to cope and how. And we have this common perception of the world as separate from ourselves. So many people believe that in this changing, impermanent world, there should be some lasting happiness, something that lasts forever, or for a very long time, or maybe an eternal soul or something like that. It's very hard to accept the fact that everything is constantly changing. It's actually nothing that is stable. And many people also believe that in this world, which is actually full of greater and lesser suffering and dissatisfaction and violence and wars and poverty and you name it, there should be an opportunity for lasting happiness and satisfaction. And many people believe that this is achieved by satisfying the desire for owning things, having a lot of money, or for some romantic love, that's gonna be the lasting happiness. And many people also have this intrinsic tendency to very often be dissatisfied with what they have and want all the things that they don't have, or more things than they actually need. So that's the greed that's rampant in the world now. And people also constantly try to escape unpleasant conditions, unpleasant emotions, pain or fear, with every means possible. And that could be alcohol, drugs, sex, television, pain, computer games, books, and all kinds of amusements. And in itself is nothing wrong too engaged in amusements once in a while, but they should be used, of course, with some moderation and awareness. Otherwise, they can take over our lives. So the Buddha realized that people make all these mistakes, misconceptions about how the world is, based on these habitual mindsets that we have been taught. And he tried to show us ways to counter these conditioned assumptions and behaviors. And that is why meditation is important, because it's a training in concentration and awareness in order to know our bodies and minds in new ways, to see how it really functions and to learn to rest in the present moment. But at sittings and retreats like this, we find ourselves in a sort of sheltered environment where not much happens, at least on the physical level. We are mostly quiet and sit still or go back and forth in walking meditation or qigong. And this is, of course, really good and necessary training. That's why we go to retreats. But it's in everyday life we should try to apply what we have learned. Because it's in everyday life we usually fall back into this habitual and conditioned behaviors, like being dissatisfied and complaining about a lot of things, even though we're basically really well off, at least compared to a lot of other places in this world. But it's really hard to come to terms to this sort of fire inside us that wants more, and the greed and the hatred. And because it's generated by the fact that our ego wants something different from what is present right now. The ego wants the world around us to behave in the way we want. And we let ourselves be guided by this little ego, which becomes annoyed and dissatisfied with a lot of things, and who believes that if the world around us would only behave properly, we would feel a lot better. And this is how we create our own mental suffering. So, what can we do about this? There are different ways to try to reprogram our minds into more wholesome patterns. And in Buddhism, there is a term called sampajana, and it's sometimes used together with the term for mindfulness, sati sampajana. So, and it can be translated as clear comprehension or clear perception, seeing clearly. And it's an aspect of mindfulness that can be applied in everyday life. It's a form of meditation that takes in the bigger picture. It's not all this so detailed. It's more a bigger picture of our daily life and actions. And there are some guidelines for how to do this or how to understand this. And of course, the first and most difficult thing about meditation in general and also about sampajana is to remember to do it. To remember that being aware is what we really want to do. And to realize that we can change our own way of thinking and acting. The outside world and other people are more difficult to change because we have no real power over them. Certainly we can try to influence try to make the world better in different ways through engaging in political work, activism, or writing. But ultimately, the lasting changes must come from within people. Otherwise, the change is not a real change. And so the second guideline is to reflect on if the purpose of our activity that you're currently involved in is a way to become more focused and aware. Or is stress and distraction taking over? Or do you always have the feeling that you're in a hurry, sort of being a step ahead of yourself? If that's the case, then the purpose of the activity is not producing more focused and aware states of mind. So then you can take a deep breath, first of all, and relax and become aware of what's happening in the body and mind. And this is called taking an M&M. You know those little chocolate candies that are, at least in America, called M&Ms? In Sweden, they're called non-stop. I don't know what you call them here. They're very hard to stop eating them once you started. Anyway, to take an M&M, that means to take 1 minute or 1 moment of meditation. 1 moment of meditation, M&M. And that's very effective to do that every time you remember. Relax, take a deep breath, become aware of the body and mind, maybe what your body is touching, if you're sitting, or if you're walking, or whatever you're doing. And you only have to do that, you know, a moment, a minute, to ground yourself, come back into the real world, instead of this sort of world where speed and distraction and stress takes over. So that's a good thing to do whenever you remember. The third guideline is to think about if my ultimate purpose is to wake up and free myself from these three root poisons, greed, hate, and ignorance. Is the way I do things appropriate for my purpose? Do I do this with underlying aversion and stress, or do I do it with kindness and compassion? Is the purpose to get things done quickly, or to be present and mindful of what I'm doing? So to act in an appropriate way, that's the third guideline, to actually check if the things we do are appropriate for this higher purpose that we might have in our life. And the fourth guideline is to remember to keep some part of your attention on any of the four areas of mindfulness, the four foundations. You can try to be grounded in the body as much as you remember. The same thing I said before with the feet touching the floor or the earth, or taking a breath and so on, or being aware of something in the mind. You know, just try to remember to keep in touch with any of the four foundations of mindfulness. Also, you can pay attention to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, and thoughts, emotions, whatever, you know. Just check in once in a while, be aware of what's happening. Another thing you can do is ask yourself from time to time, is this thing that I might be annoyed about or sad about, is it really true? Is it really important? And if you discover that, in fact, it is the thoughts that are exaggerating or projecting events into the future, you know, something has happened and you have this whole train of thoughts about what catastrophes this is gonna cause in the future. And that's really not useful to do that, because most of the time when we plan the future, it turns out not the way we planned, completely other way. So this is totally unnecessary to do. But when you discover that you're doing that, you shouldn't either fall into the trap that we very often do of condemning ourselves. Wow, I'm really stupid, or, you know, this kind of self-hatred. Instead, you can rejoice that you have actually managed to pay attention enough to discover the ego's habitual tricks that it plays on you. And as I said before, smiling a little bit at yourself is actually much better than being angry. That's what Thich Nhat Hanh, this Vietnamese Zen master, he really recommends that we smile also when we meditate. Because also science says that a smile creates endorphins, which are those happiness hormones, and it makes you feel a little happier when you smile. You can also think about if you can do something about, if there is some trouble, if you can do something about it without hurting yourself or others, then you can, of course, do it, try to change it. But very often we can't do anything about things. And then you have to realize that it is dukkha, or the imperfection of the world, the way the world is. And it is manifesting itself in a perfectly normal and natural way. Dukkha is normal. It's not something that's wrong. It just, we have through advertising and all this brainwashing come to the have the idea that happiness should be the normal state of the world. But actually, dukkha, imperfection, is the normal state of the world. It's never quite perfect. So if you find that it's the normal imperfections of the world manifesting themselves, then the best thing to do is to let it be, since it will eventually change according to nature's law about impermanence. Everything changes. The problem is that we are conditioned to always relate everything that is happening around us and the feelings it creates in our mind to I, me, and mine. So in other words, we see it as we own the feelings of irritation, anger, sadness, whatever it can be. And then sometimes we also blame it on other people. I'm angry because so and so did this and this. They didn't behave the way I want. And if we really can see the reality as it is, we could much easier let go and continue without causing ourselves all this unnecessary suffering due to often quite unimportant events. We have to take responsibility for our own reactions and not always blame others. And this is called trying to live without preconceived ideas or illusions about how life should be. So according to a Buddhist way of looking at the mind, many of the thoughts and emotions that arise are passing and impersonal phenomena. I read once what Sri Nisargadatta, an Indian teacher, answered to the question if he ever became impatient. And he responded smiling, "I see, hear, and feel like everyone else. I feel hungry and thirsty. If lunch is not served on time, impatience may also occur. I see this clearly, but in some way I'm not absorbed by the feelings. I'm aware of them, but there is a distance. Restlessness, anger, irritation, or hunger arises. But I don't need to take everything personally. It has nothing to do with who I really am." So Sri Nisargadatta is considered to be an enlightened master. But what he points to is a change in the identity where he doesn't see himself as the center and reference point of the world. He doesn't see himself as the individual who suffers from all these contradictory and troublesome emotions and events, but he sees himself as a smaller part of this great circle of constant change, where we are all interrelated with everything else in this world, everyone and everything. And the sometimes unpleasant things that happen to us are not attached to a self, but it's part of a bigger process and a result of how the world really is. We don't live in a perfect world. We live in a world that is characterized by unsatisfactoriness and impermanence. And how then can we expect that our little lives should be constantly smooth and happy? So in summary, we can practice clear comprehension of daily life by reflecting on the underlying purpose of our activities. We can also think about if our actions are appropriate and serves this purpose. And we can try to be grounded and present in the body and also keep track of feelings and other mental activities. And finally, to be aware that it's not needed that we take everything personally. We don't have to relate everything to our own little ego and miss seeing this interrelated and changing nature of the world. So, of course, it's impossible to decide that from today I will not take anything personally. It won't work that way. But if we're aware that the possibility exists and we can use our meditation training to become more aware of our responses in daily life, it will have a very positive impact on our well-being. So Achan Amaro, who I'm quoted before, the monk in the Forest Sangha tradition, he says, according to classical Buddhist understanding, a person doesn't have problems. The person is the problem. It's because we relate everything in terms of me and mine, that we continue to suffer and to be unsatisfied. We have to make a paradigm shift from me and my problems to mindfulness that sees the phenomena occur and pass away. So how much then should you meditate every day? So one teacher says you should meditate at least 20 minutes a day. Unless you're very busy and stressed, then you should meditate an hour. That's quite a good rule. But the main thing is that we try to sit some time every day and that we try to pay attention in daily life as often as we can, as often as we remember. And of course, reading Dhamma books and listening to recorded Dhamma talks can also be inspiring at times. And there's a lot online. There's a Dharma Seed or an audio Dharma. And all these talks at Niroda's retreats are on their homepage. You can listen to that after. And having a Sangha, a society of like-minded friends, going to group sittings and retreats from time to time, is also a way of keeping Dhamma practice alive. And there is advice, a little bit controversial advice, and that is to be less social and engaged in society, in social life. Because sometimes we do things out of old habit or because it's expected of us. We have friends from when we were young and we have always done this. And even, so we do it, even if we start feeling that it is, it's not, we don't really get much out of it. It just takes up a lot of time that could be used for other things, spiritual practice, for example. And I'm going to end with a poem that illustrates this in a rather drastic and funny way, but there is some truth in it. And this poem is called The Art of Disappearing, and the poet is Naomi Shihab Nye. So The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem, greasy sausage balls on a paper plate, then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say, "Why?" It's not that you don't love them anymore, but you're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. No, you could tumble down any second. Then decide what you want to do with your time. So let's sit a moment.